putting together Sunstone and I began to see some of the papers coming in, I told Kathy that I would be happy to chair anything that she needed, but I was particularly interested in this session. So I'm happy that I was able to get it. I know you can all read the little bio on Paul Smith. And I was just asking him where he's doing his philosophy studies right now, and he's at Maryland. I don't know if how many of you are familiar with this remote viewing program. I first became aware when it hit the newspaper. When was the big kind of...
It's about November, December 95.
That's what I was thinking. It was about a year and a half or so ago. And I remember when I was first reading it, I mean, it caused all this furor, and people were just horrified we were putting our money into this, and I was fascinated because it had been my privilege to know several people who were gifted / skilled in these kinds of areas, and I'd been able to observe these skills up close and personal, and so I was really quite interested in all of this. And then as I began to hear a little bit more, I was even more fascinated to learn that we had one of our very own in this company. And so I know he'll be talking a lot more about that. So I'm just going to turn the time over to Paul Smith. Thanks.
I'm glad to see you all here. This is probably the largest turnout I've ever had, one of these things. For years, rumors floated around Washington that the Pentagon was using psychics to collect intelligence. In the early and mid-80s, investigative journalist Jack Anderson ran a number of columns with bits and pieces of information he'd gleaned from confidential sources about these so-called Psi spies. Every once in a while, others would surface with news alleging that the military consulted fortune tellers or crystal ball gazers to answer questions or solve intelligence problems that couldn't be handled with more conventional means. There was even one report that the Navy had tried communicating with one of its submarines under the ice cap using telepathy. Then, in the fall of 1995, the CIA officially confirmed much of the story. A secret unit managed first by the Army and later by the Defense Intelligence Agency... Another cartoon for you. Oh. Get the hang of it eventually. I should have known that, right? Okay. Later managed by the Defense Intelligence Agency and based at Fort Meade, Maryland, had for 17 years been using a so-called psychic skill known as remote viewing, or as I often refer to it, RV, to gather intelligence about threats to national security. Remote viewing was a sort of disciplined clairvoyance that allowed those trained in the skill to spy on targets closed to all other means of access. During its existence, the unit collected intelligence on a broad range of targets: strategic missile forces, political leaders, narcotics operations, research and development facilities, hostage situations, military weapons, secret military installations, technology developments. The list encompassed nearly every category of intelligence target. In 1995, Congress directed the CIA take over the program from DIA, and CIA didn't want it, even though during the 80s it had been one of the unit's most frequent patrons. The RV program, known in its final iteration by the codename Stargate, and many of you may have heard that term, was canceled by the CIA in June of 1995, the agency conveniently keeping for itself all the personnel slots that came with the program. While the details of this story are fascinating, they merely set the stage for something much more interesting. And for 7 of the 17 years the intelligence unit existed, I was a member of it. I was trained to be a remote viewer, and ultimately I performed somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 of these remote viewing sessions. But that's only the beginning of this story. Let me first give you a little bit better grasp of what remote viewing is. By definition, remote viewing is a skill that allows a human remote viewer, as we call them, to consciously obtain information from a location, person, or event inaccessible to that human because of distance or shielding or time or whatever, and that person has no other conventional means or contact with the target. As I mentioned, I refer to it as disciplined clairvoyance, since one of the most important features of it is the self-control of mental noise. In so-called traditional ESP, one of the biggest problems has always been the competition that one's own mind provides in the form of internally created impressions, suggestions, imaginings, that kind of thing. They conflict with this so-called psychic signal that comes in and contaminate the information that you get. Remote viewers refer to this noise as analytic overlay, or AOL. Write that on the board.
So when I use the acronym, you'll recognize it again.
There were two credible types of remote viewing down at Fort Meade. One we called ERV, or extended remote viewing. It was based on traditional relaxation, meditation kind of techniques. So basically, the remote viewer would lay on a bed and kind of get right on the verge of sleep and then be debriefed by someone else in the room that would ask them questions and help guide them around. The other approach was developed at SRI International, which is a major West Coast think tank. It was known as coordinate remote viewing, or CRV. In CRV, the remote viewer remains fully conscious, sitting upright at a table, and accesses the psychic signal through a series of strict protocols or methods that are equipped to help them get rid of the mental noise that comes in. Although ERV produced some very spectacular results, CRV actually produced quality information more consistently, and so it became the primary method that was used while at Fort, during the main years at Fort Meade. In the CRV process, which is the one that I was trained in, the viewer is given an abstract coordinate, which is basically just the number that stands for the target that they want you to address. This number acts as a psychic address to the target and cues the viewer's subconscious to react, first by actually accessing the target, and then by facilitating the process by which that information then is basically brought into your mind. At first, you get the data in a form of very simple impressions that provide an overall concept of the target. It's a mountain, or it's a building, or it's a person, or it's an event. It's just a very fundamental idea about it. Next, you start getting sensory data, things that you would experience were you personally at the site, even though you're not. You might get colors, sense of textures. If there's some really pronounced smells there, you actually might even sense smell. It's not that you actually smell it. You can tell the difference between something you smell while you're there or something you smell when you're there psychically. It's kind of a half-formed memory that comes in. You learn to distinguish it. After these sensory pieces of information come in, you move into dimensionals, and you start getting a feel for how this thing is put together physically. You get, you know, tallness, width, roundness, depth, you know, any kind of aspect of dimensionality that you might perceive. Following the dimensions, you do some sketching. It leads into more complex information, ideas such as governmental or secret or electronics or aircraft-related weapons systems, missile, you know, all these kind of things can come in at that point. The process continues getting more and more complex, and you get greater and more detailed perceptions of what the target is involved with, until a certain point you actually can even, if it's a suitable target, make a three-dimensional representation of it with clay or some kind of little construction materials. You can actually build something in the shape of whatever that particular target is. I don't know, how many here saw Close Encounters of the Third Kind? You know that mashed potato mountain? When I saw that movie, I said, I've been doing that for years! Actually, I saw the movie first. I recognized it when I learned it. But okay, of course, the question in the end is remote viewing effective? And, of course, the skeptics always say no. However, after about 25 years of experimental and operational remote viewing experience, the track record is pretty convincing for anyone willing to consider the evidence objectively. Unfortunately, most of the operational data collected by the government program still awaits declassification, but there is enough information outside the security envelope to provide a pretty convincing case. First, there's a considerable body of data available among the various civilian researchers who have explored the phenomenon. Now, I had listed some of that, but in the interest of time, I'm not going into that. If you're curious, we can talk about it afterwards. Further, there's been some evidence that has leaked out of the government program as well. Just one example, a report on the use of remote viewing in support of counter-drug operations in 1989-90 concluded that 35% of the information provided by remote viewers was of significant value, and in several cases led to either recovery of contraband, apprehension of smugglers, or both. A higher percentage of information was deemed accurate but not useful for law enforcement purposes. Interestingly, RV as an intelligence source scored higher than any of the conventional intelligence methods also employed by that drug interdiction task force. Significantly higher. Human intelligence provided, they figured there was about 10% accurate. Satellite intelligence was virtually useless. So it was quite interesting to see the contrast there. However, the best way to determine whether remote viewing works is to actually see some successful sessions. Let me show you some examples of successful RV projects. This is what you're waiting for, right? Let me start off here by showing you, walking you through an elementary CRV session. And this is one I did back when I was just training back in 84, and I'll just show you the different parts of it. You start off with a coordinate, which the Xerox machine cut off part of it, that doesn't matter. You take a coordinate, you get what's called an ideogram, which is just a reflexive response to the signaling, the psychic signaling actually being detected by you physically. You start then getting the sensory data. This I didn't determine what it was. It turned out to be a structure, but I didn't capture that right off. Started describing it, and I'll have to interpret this in my handwriting, I admit, it's terrible. Faceted, domed, shiny, arches, geometrical, broad, hemispherical, vast volume, I can't even read that, raised up, water, traffic sounds, exposed, open, large, looming, and so on. And I got what's called here's AOL. Remember I mentioned AOL? You get an analytic overlay that's your mind trying to tell you what it is, but you know that your mind doesn't know what it's talking about. So you just expel that by saying AOL break and then saying what it is, a geodesic dome. I got the impression of a geodesic dome, and I knew that wasn't real. It was something that reminded me of a geodesic dome. And you'll see how that goes here in a second. This is the next page. I'll just briefly hit this one. You can see I actually even got a sketch of one of these AOLs. It reminded me of the Dew Line, you know, that early warning system lit up in Alaska. Then I got some more of these sensory things. These are actually a little more than sensory, but I didn't know how to handle it at that time. Corrugated, dark colors, metal, cavernous, tear, spired. That was interesting. And I got this AOL of the Blue Mosque in Istanbul. Anybody know what that is? You know what it is. Yeah, it's this huge thing in Istanbul. And then I drew this little kind of a sketch thing here. Another AOL of Taj Mahal. Some more sketches here. Well, I need static guard on these overlays here. Just, you know, trying to grasp what this was that I was getting. I just didn't, you know, I didn't people's way here. This didn't Xerox real well, but you can see I'm trying to put it together here. And then finally, the last page, and this one went pretty quick. That was the final sketch. And if you'll note, I said AOL break of a mosque or a church feel. Now that's quite interesting. Because I actually was right on the previous page. It was the Hagia, or it was the Blue Mosque, or the Hagia Sophia, as it was called by the Greek Orthodox Church. That was the site. Now, mosque or church feel, it used to be church, it's now a mosque. So that was a little more revealing than I thought it was. Normally a session doesn't go this fast. I should say it does go this fast, and this is an elementary level. Normally a session is much more involved when you're doing operational targets. Because you want to get into all the nitty gritty, the stuff the intel people don't know and they want to find out. I've been in operational sessions where they walked me from room to room to room to room, describing what was in each room as much as possible. And you never get it 100%. You get bits and pieces, but the idea is they want to know as much as you can tell them, because one little piece of information may be the clue. So they can determine whether it is a bioengineering facility, a tank production plant. I'll take questions afterwards, okay? Write them down, because hopefully we'll give you time for that. And they want to get indicators to try and identify, whereas in some of these areas we couldn't get anybody into. Couldn't get spies into, satellites, all they got was the top of the roof, you know, that kind of stuff. And they use this for that kind of thing. Anyway, I think I'm getting ahead of myself. Okay, let me show you a couple of actual, just the results and what the actual target was here. Of some more training sessions. Now, these didn't photocopy real well, but those of you who have been to Washington State may recognize Grand Coulee Dam up here. Now, of course, remember, the viewer is totally blind. They have no idea what the site is. They're just given a number, and they proceed from there to describe whatever they see. And when they finally get down to the end, if they've gone all the way through the advanced levels of this thing, they actually make a three-dimensional model, okay? And that's what we have here. We've got Grand Coulee Dam, the abutments on either side, the powerhouse here. And then, if you'll note, this guy has made a model of it. Abutments here, powerhouse here. Of course, he didn't know it was a powerhouse. That's another interesting thing I'll explain in a minute. The dam across, and this was blue magic marker. He knew it was a dam. He didn't know what dam it was. Okay. This was a fun one. Most of these are from the same guy because they're from the report, which is much more concise and easy to look at. This is the Bunker Hill Memorial, and when he built this thing, he couldn't quite get the top of it. He knew there was somehow it went together. We weren't quite sure how it was. There is a road that runs down here, and then a kind of a ring walkway, which he was trying to capture with this. But you notice the little lines in the tower here? He knew that they needed to be scored. Somehow he got the impression of this layered kind of an effect on the thing. Can you tell I get a kick out showing these off? This one was, everybody thought this was great. This is Tulum in Mexico. The photographer took this, didn't know that this stuff dried up and this fell down. This was supposed to be up here when this was originally made. This set of stairs was up here, and if you know, you've got the stairs up here. And when the guy did this session, he actually was trying to vocalize the name of the place, and he got T-U-L-U. And he wasn't quite sure where it went on from there, you know, but it's Tulum. He just missed the M. It would have been great if he could have captured that. This one, I enjoy this one as well. This is the response. This is what the viewer produced. If you'll note, you got this tall cylindrical thing with a ball on the top. You've got these three large cylinders, and there are oblong rectangular shapes in here, and this running around like this. And then you've got a bunch of dots here. They've got a little kind of tower-like thing here. He said there's a whole bunch of these, but he didn't want to make them all, so he just made one and put dots where the rest of them were, right? Well, here was the site that he was meant to address. This is a site, I don't know where this plant is, some nuclear plant somewhere, but you see you've got the water tower here with the little ball on the top, the three containment towers. You've got a lot more structures in here than he made. I mean, we can forgive him for that, right? And see this substation back here with all these towers and all that stuff? And there's, by the way, a containment berm around this thing. In fact, I think it was right here. There's a built-up levee that went around it, which is somewhat similar to what he made with clay there. So, anyway, you can see that there, you know, of course you're just taking my word for this, right? But you can see that there may indeed be an effect here, something that might be worth pursuing, right? Okay. If you are interested, by the way, I'm going to put an unpaid political announcement up here. A guy's written a book about this, which I think is pretty good. It's got some inaccuracies, but overall it gives a good feel for the program. So, you know, if you're interested, you can find that. It's a paperback, so it's not too expensive. A lot of the Crown and B. Dalton's have that. In fact, I have two copies. If anybody's interested, I'll sell it to you at cost. So, anyway, you can check that out, and I'll give you a reference thing afterwards anyway. So, okay. Oh, I need to put this up too. Where is it? I probably lost it. Ah, this one's a little fun. Now that you've seen all the pictures, right? It says, "I'm still not convinced I wanted the pepper." Okay. Okay. You have to remember, remote viewing isn't always successful. There are some commercial practitioners of it. A number of people got out of the military, decided they wanted to earn money, like me, doing this stuff. And they will make all kinds of claims about it that really aren't true. And I think that's actually a disadvantage because they raise expectations of what remote viewing is capable of, and then when it doesn't come through to the extent that they are claiming, kind of falls on its face. It is not 100% successful. We find that somewhere between 60 to 80% of the time, the viewer produces information that shows that they're on target. Somewhat less percentage of time than that, they produce valuable information that addresses the question they're supposed to answer. It's still not perfect, but heck, it's a whole lot better than anything else you got to work with in some of these circumstances. Okay. Now, stories of governmental use of psychic phenomenon can be quite titillating, as the immense media interest generated by the CIA's revelations at the end of 1995 show. But there is a far deeper aspect that is usually missed by the hype and hoopla. I believe one of the primary reasons skeptics continue so violently to reject evidence that humans indeed can function psychically is because of what that might mean for our current scientifically based intellectual paradigm. Those are way too many syllables for my wife. She doesn't like me to talk in those long words, but oh well. Steeped in the tradition of the great empiricist philosophers and totally immersed, she really hated this sentence, totally immersed in the materialist ideologies of this century's logical positivist thinkers, Now you understand, too. Don't you? There is no room for anything that cannot be explained within our current model of the physical universe. Religion has felt the sting of this, so has parapsychology. Materialists reject the notion of psychic functioning for what to them are very good reasons. If a replicable psychic effect can be achieved and demonstrated essentially at will, and if no physically based theory can account for that effect, then perhaps we have reason now to believe that we indeed may be more than our physical bodies, that there may indeed be something beyond this world, this material universe, even beyond this life, contrary to what philosophy abetted by science has been preaching for a century and more. The floodgates might indeed open to what Carl Sagan disparagingly called the demon-haunted world of spirituality and religion. I believe that properly executed remote viewing is that replicable psychic effect that parapsychology researchers have hoped for and skeptics feared. This has profound implications for our culture and our view of the universe, but I'm not here to talk about the impact of science and the Western intellectual tradition, except tangentially. I want to address how my experiences and the understandings I've come to have affected how I understand the gospel and what I've been taught as a member of the LDS Church, what I think the existence of this phenomenon means for the church. First, you may know that for almost 10 years now, I've been affiliated with Sunstone. I've written five or six papers, presented them at various symposiums. I've probably chaired or responded to a dozen or two dozen sessions at various times over that period. But I'm under no illusions. I've only made a modest contribution to Sunstone. There are many who have contributed much more. But during that contribution, I have consistently tried to sound a minor key in opposition to what I still believe is an empiricist materialist bias in the fabric of these symposia. Unbeknownst to any but a few of my intimates, nearly everything I have presented during my involvement with Sunstone has been colored by my experience with remote viewing. My very first paper presented in Salt Lake in 1988, some of you may have heard of this one. It's got a difficult to pronounce title. It's another one my wife hates. Mormonism and the 100th Monkey, LDS Doctrine in Light of Rupert Sheldrake's Hypothesis of Formative Causation. Anybody heard of this one? Fairness mattering. Yeah. Okay. I'm not going to get into what that paper says here, but I wanted to say that Sheldrake proposes a model that could well establish a link between our materialist science and what I've come to perceive as the spiritual realities that go beyond the physical universe. Sheldrake's ideas find great serendipity with the teachings of the restored gospel. A second Sunstone paper was Mormonism and the New Age, in which I treated a number of topics relating to the metaphysical leanings in the New Age movement and what connections and dissonances there might be with the LDS Church. Much of my own model that reconciles Mormonism and parapsychology I included in that paper. My paper, Illusions of Autocracy, Why the LDS Church Isn't as Dictatorial as It Looks, but What Makes It Sometimes Seem That Way, explored how, when we think we see failings and weaknesses in the organizational church, the weaknesses we encounter are often really those either in the very human personalities of our leaders or our own, or sometimes both. The insights I brought out in that presentation were gleaned from my time as recruiting and assessment officer for the remote viewing unit. Using some of the assessment tools, particularly the Myers-Briggs Personality Profile Instrument, I gained a whole new perspective of the importance of individual personalities on organizations, in organizations, how they all interact, and how people perceive organizations because of their differing personality types. Three other papers I wrote, War in Heaven, War on Earth, The Militaristic Gospel of Jesus Christ, Secret Yes, But Sacred Too, Ambivalent Attitudes Toward the Temple, and especially one wrote, Mormonism Seduced, the Materialist Worldview, and the LDS Church, were heavily influenced by my realization that there was far more to reality than what our modern world has limited itself to believe. And I talked about the seduction of Mormon intellectuals by that beckoning mirage. In 1988, I had already been a remote viewer for 5 years. I was forbidden on pain of prosecution, loss of career, and confinement if I spoke directly of it. Now, in a sense, coming full circle with this paper, I can talk relatively freely about these experiences and how they've affected my life, and I think how they will eventually have a profound effect on the world in which we all live. I'm going to go on now to explain how I think it fits within the LDS context. As we learn from LDS teachings, our lives didn't start with mortal birth, as many other religions believe, but rather we lived in the pre-existence of spirits. And of course, according to the missionary discussions I had, the rainbow discussions, if any of you had those, a spirit is basically could, you know, talk without speaking and go places without walking and somehow or other, I guess, through some intangible way, know things about some other places than where they were. All because they had no physical bodies. When you read the writings of early church leaders and read in the scriptures, we find that model somewhat confirmed. When we come into this existence, our spirits somehow become bonded with our bodies in a way we don't yet understand. We also pass through this thing we call a veil, whatever that might be, which prevents us from knowing essentially anything about the spirit world from which we came. However, we may have lost a Though we may have lost awareness of our celestial origins, nowhere does it say that we lost our previously held spiritual powers. At most, it seems to me, we may have forgotten them, and in fact, I suspect that whenever somebody develops some kind of psychic functioning or ability to do this kind of thing, rather than learning something new, they're really just remembering things that they once knew, perhaps in the pre-existence, and they're just starting to sink in. But they still remember them fleetingly and somewhat imperfectly. In a sense, then, remote viewing, you might say, is an attempt at spiritual seeing, filtered through the heavy screen as a glass darkly of our physical mental process. This leads to some interesting thoughts regarding spirits and bodies together being the souls of human beings. One of the things that we're taught as part of our mission here on Earth is to learn to allow our spirits to rule our bodies, and we usually take that to understand that that means we are supposed to allow our bodies to be subject to our spirits, and we subject our appetites and all that to the constraints of the spirit and the commandments of God. I'd like to suggest that maybe there's a little more to it than that. Maybe we are also supposed to learn eventually how one functions spiritually while still in our bodies, which it seems that both God and Jesus Christ currently are able to do. I don't think that we gain a full functionality of this within this particular existence, this mortal existence, but I think some of us can make a start on it while we are here. There's also an issue, of course, and this was already asked me once today, what is the source of the information that one receives while remote viewing? Some more conservative Mormons are convinced that there are only two possible sources, God and Satan. Let me turn this off for a while. But I believe otherwise. We learn in the Doctrine and Covenants that the power is in us to do much good without being directly moved to do it by God or by Satan. Just as we can conceive and perform good acts on our own, we can also conceive and perform evil acts without necessarily being influenced by the devil. We Mormons also believe, contrary to any other Christian religion, that our ultimate existence is not dependent on God. We existed as intelligences before we were spirits, and these intelligences were, as Joseph Smith in some of his writings, he uses the term co-evil, with an A, not an I. These intelligences were co-evil with God. Some fundamental essence of each of us has been around just as long as God has. He clearly has much more power and glory than do we, yet we ultimately exist independently of him. The very fact that we have this necessary existence means that we have some power. However many it be, that is our own, and I strongly suspect that being subsequently created as spirits, then acquiring physical bodies, has augmented that power somewhat. So we are indeed agents unto ourselves, and we must decide how we will use our agency and what power there is that comes with it. Just as we can use our physical strength either to assault or rescue someone, I think we have these spiritual powers which we may also choose to use for good or ill. One obvious question is how the Holy Ghost fits into this. One thing I think that a lot that we attribute to the Holy Ghost is actually the Spirit working through our own resources to help us help ourselves. I believe, for example, that we possess much unconscious power to heal our own bodies. The Holy Ghost, through prayer and priesthood blessings, is requested perhaps not so much as to heal us directly, but perhaps rather to unlock the power we ourselves have below the level of our temporal awareness, in effect guiding our own spirits as participants in the healing process themselves. I suspect further that much of the inspiration and outright revelation we receive in our lives is not new information poured directly into our minds by the Holy Ghost, but rather something to which we have instead been guided and about which we must form the correct conclusions. Or they are cognitions to which we have been helped when the Spirit has prompted us to associate knowledge we already possess in ways that never would have occurred to us, but which nevertheless provide us a profound answer to questions with which we struggle. And finally, I suspect that the same pathways through which remote viewer gains information are those same ones used by the Holy Ghost. I use an analogy here about the main line, but you know, out here runs into Union Station. There are commuter trains that come down from Baltimore all the time, back and forth, back and forth. But there's the long-haul Amtrak passenger lines, a real luxury outfit, you know, that make these day-long trips across the country that also come down those same tracks. I think our pitiful attempts at remote viewing and psychic functioning and all that, I think that's equivalent to those commuter trains going back and forth, you know, on those tracks, and kind of a plebeian sort of an approach. And the Holy Ghost might be the equivalent of the huge metro liners, you know, that come in from Chicago or wherever, that bring, you know, larger groups of people, you know, and whatever. So I don't want to overdo that analogy, but you get the idea. Okay. I don't claim to be the recipient of more inspiration or revelation for myself or my stewardships than any other member of the church. However, I think I do understand the process much better than I would have had I not had these experiences. First, I have absolutely no doubts that inspiration and revelation can and do occur, and that they emanate from a source outside our individual selves. In an era in which the secular world explains such things away as mere rumblings from one's subconscious or as the brain's right hemisphere whispering to the left, this insight is of no little consequence. Second, I recognize the subtlety of the spiritual signal like a psychic signal. There is a qualitative difference between it and our typical mental processes, but it is so rarefied and nuanced that if one is not practiced in the art of recognizing it, it is easily lost amongst our many other thoughts and imaginings. Still small voice may strike us as nicely poetic turn of phrase, but it also profoundly captures the precise way in which the Spirit speaks to us. Our teachers and church leaders are not exaggerating when they continually urge upon us the need to listen to that still small voice and to continually work at increasing our receptivity to it and our ability to identify when we are being spoken to. This leads directly to my third point, the problem of signal-to-noise ratio. This is a term that remote viewing theory borrowed from radio propagation theory. Two rather complex topics, but at any rate, it has real correlation to the principle of revelation. I earlier mentioned analytic overlay, or AOL. AOL is really only a number of sources of mental noise. It can include things such as physical inclemencies that a person may experience, imaginative, emotional, and, believe it or not, even telepathic overlay. All these things act to obscure the actual signal that's coming in. And, in fact, remote viewing was developed, the whole structure of remote viewing was developed to help the viewer overcome this noise that's coming in so they can extract the real data from the imagined stuff. In fact, without this structure, no psychic would function any better than the 20% effectiveness that even the best storefront or talk show psychics seem able to muster. All of us run into these same problems in determining if we are perceiving the still small voice or instead merely the whinings of our own egos, the urges of our own wants and desires, or the overlay of our own imaginations. Yet just as one can master the structured discipline of remote viewing to allow one to more confidently separate signal wheat from noise chaff, we can develop our own spiritual discipline that can help us separate revelatory signal from our own subjective noise. Now, I want to talk briefly about prophecy, free will, and the foreknowledge of God, which in itself could be an entire devoted entire session to. But I want to start off by telling about a remote viewing session I performed on the 15th of May, I believe it was, in 1987. We occasionally did these things called directed searches, in which the coordinate didn't really stand for any target. The viewer had no idea. All they ever got was a number. So they just went over and addressed that particular number and whatever came to mind in the process. But a directed search was, you went over there, they gave you a number. The number stood for whatever was significant out there. They wanted us to report on whatever was significant to report on, just kind of a wild card kind of thing. So I went over there, did the session. I started describing this thing. I had this perception of a steel, metallic, eventually realized it was a ship. In fact, it became a warship, and it was nighttime. It was in a body of water that was fairly constricted. It was like it was enclosed, at least on three sides, and bounded by land that was very arid, sandy. It was desert-like, third world sort of a feel, there was a military involved in one of these, in part of the land that had a feel of being military, but not very professional at it. You know, they wore tan and black uniforms, and the colors red, I don't remember, red, green, and black were important to them. At any rate, this warship is sailing along. It's late at night. Most people are asleep. I was getting sounds of a smell of, what was it, onions, I think, frying, or something frying, bed breaking. I don't remember what. It was one of some of the sensory things I got. And everything was peaceful. And then I perceived this aircraft. And it took off, and it was flying around, and it dropped something that emitted a steady roaring kind of a sound that flew through the air and had little short wings. And eventually, this object struck this ship, and there was a flame and smoke and people screaming and hoses and all kinds of things, you know, fire hoses and all that kind of stuff. I was getting all of this kind of jumbled up impressions of this real catastrophic kind of an event. The aircraft seemed, the whole event seemed to have been not exactly planned, but kind of a game of chicken that had gone awry, and the aircraft had been directed by some people much farther away up in the heart of this sandy desert land. In a city that had flat-top roofs and, in fact, some livestock living in the streets and that kind of thing. And there's much more detail to it, but you get the kind of outline of this event. My monitor at the time, who had expected me to come up with something else, he started shaking his head and say, "Oh, you're off." You can't be on all the time. I understand it's okay, but this just doesn't match what I was expecting. So let's just wrap it up and call it a day. And so we went home for the weekend. Well, I was just waking up, and I get this phone call on Monday morning, and they said, "Paul, have you seen the paper yet?" And I said, "No, why? Is there something in it?" They said, "Yes, and we want you to come in here and find that session, dig it out of the safe." And that was upside down. It really sank, didn't it? That was the event that happened on Sunday, 2 to 3 days after I did that session. Now, many of you may recall that event, the start being hit by the Iraqi missile. One of the things I'd said is I thought these people spoke Arabic, but I didn't write that down. If you don't write it down, it doesn't count. So I have no evidence that I really said that. I'd been an Arab linguist as an enlisted person, and so it seemed familiar. It seemed like they were speaking Arabic. But it was interesting. I later got the full result, what do they call it, the after-action report that the Navy published on this thing about a year or two later. And in my session, which went on for, in fact, I have it in my briefcase here, a TypeScript, it went on for page after page after page, there was not a single thing in there that wasn't accurate. I was completely dumbfounded, as were the other people there. In fact, I got into the office, they said, "There's that thing, we want it right now," and I had to dig it out. They said, "Write up a report on it, we're going to send it downtown." So, you know, we sent it down, and that's the last we heard of it. That's typical, though, you know, we never get any feedback from those guys. At any rate, this highlighted some strengths of this process and some weaknesses. The strength is, it's great if you know something's going to happen before it happens, right? The unfortunate thing is, we could not do a single thing about it, even if we thought it was real. First of all, what do? You put somebody on a war footing for something that hasn't happened yet, you know? And then if it does happen, if it doesn't happen, if you do put them on a war footing, you get them all set up, and it doesn't happen, then of course your prophecy, as it were, failed, right? That's what I call a Jonah effect, you know? Nineveh didn't fall, and so Jonah thought God was lying to him, essentially, you know? You run into problems like that. But this whole concept of being able to perceive the future, however imperfectly, has some interesting implications for Mormon doctrine and for our concept of free will, and hopefully I can take a minute and go into that. It's interesting, a remote viewer can access the past very easily. I've been to Ground Zero at Hiroshima. It was dang hot, I'll tell you. I've been to Dachau, and that was a very unpleasant experience. I was tasked against a Soviet biological accident that happened in, I don't know, some off in the Urals somewhere. And that was really miserable. That was a bad experience. But, you know, all these things were in the past. There is some effect, some possibility of even accessing the future, as this shows. But the future is much less reliable, and for the following reason, I believe. When we start here, going back, the past is one channel. It's already happened. It's already fixed. Going into the future, it hasn't happened yet. And there are a diverse number of possible futures that exist. And which particular branch of all those branching possible futures is determined by what particular decision event is met in any one of those forks. And so when you remote view the future, you may pick up a perfectly valid possible future over here that doesn't happen because before the future reaches that, it gets branched off and goes somewhere else. You're not wrong, at least at the time you do it, but ultimately you turn out to be wrong because the future went some other direction. Well, I'm cutting this very short. I think that my own particular interpretation of whether God knows everything is that, yeah, he does know everything. What he knows about our future, though, is all the possible futures. He knows what all those where all those branches go. I'm not so sure he knows which decision nodes are going to be met. And so, you know, there's always been this long ongoing argument about whether if God knows everything, including how our future will turn out, can there really be free will? I think the fact that we are dealing with this kind of fractalization of the future may well be how we have free will and how we can make decisions and how we can guide our lives. But anyway, we can talk about that later because we're running short on time. I'm going to turn to my final topic. I want to return to something more concrete in the subject of materialism. As I mentioned before, I think there's an unfortunate trend in Sunstone and other places where some have fallen victim to the rampant mechanistic reductionistic, there's another favorite phrase of my wife's, mechanistic reductionistic paradigm that has so successfully overwhelmed all comers in science and essentially put religion to rout. The problem is not peculiar only here. I think even in the institutional church there's some problems. If you want to hear my thoughts on that, I'll get you a copy of my materialism paper. There are two reasons for this. One is that our culture is so thoroughly steeped in this materialist attitude, it's impossible to escape infection altogether. But even more, it's because this paradigm works so well. The materialist scientific method, it works very well. It's explained just about, well, I won't say just about everything, but it's on its way to explain just about everything you can explain about physical phenomena. It's hard to argue with success. In fact, one of my philosophy professors was trying recently to explain why he's convinced that there will eventually be a materialist model explaining consciousness exclusively in terms of brain processes. That would, of course, destroy once and for all any notion that there was any sort of extra physical element such as spirit or mind that accounts for us being sentient beings. Reductionist science, he proclaimed, has been astoundingly successful in answering the riddles of the physical universe. And so many times he declared things that were thought to be beyond physical explanation or only explainable in spiritual terms have ultimately been demonstrated to be a function of matter or physical law. What my professor and many more like him are in deep denial of is that science only explains those things it can explain. Like Procrustes, it cuts off and throws away anything doesn't fit, declaring it non-existent. Later during that same class, my professor was asked by another student why science hadn't yet managed to fully explain away and put to rest such phenomena as UFOs and parapsychology. Of course, I wouldn't dare ask that question, but anyway, he was asked that. His answer was that such things are just too hard for science to do. It couldn't get a grip on them because even assuming they had any reality, they likely could not be explained in material terms and therefore were not a suitable thing for science to pursue. So, I remembered at that point the joke about a man who's on his hands and knees under a street lamp late one evening looking for a lost contact lens. When asked by a passerby where it was that he had lost the lens, he pointed off into the shadow somewhere. And the passerby says, "Well, why are you looking here?" And he said, "Because this is where the light is." I often see science doing that very thing. To a great degree, we inherit this attitude from the logical positive philosophy of the 20s and through 50s. The logical positivist advocated the verifiability principle, which basically said that if you can't observe it directly or measure it, it's nonsense. You can't even talk about it being real. And, of course, there goes religion and everything else that you can't measure or observe directly. The verifiability principle, interestingly enough, collapsed all in its own right because there are a lot of things that you couldn't observe directly, like numbers and things like that. But at any rate, the materialist tradition remains basic to today's academic culture and decrees the narrow constraints of evidence that any ology may accept. The tradition exercises great influence on all of us, who often without realizing it come to feel that the only valid yardstick to use in assessing the church is one forged from the brittle steel of empirical reductionism. Okay, I don't want you to get confused. I really do respect the scientific method and rational thought as a way of uncovering knowledge. I think that the problem is when we go beyond using them as tools and make them religions in their own right, which we tend to do in our society. They're useful in combating ignorance, prejudice, and stupidity, sometimes even where the church is concerned. But when we start accepting them as the only thing there is, then we run into problems because they are really just another tool crafted by mere human hands. And there are a lot of things that science can't explain and just ignores. All this is, and this is where my experience with remote viewing enters the discussion. Speaking right now in purely in secular terms, The existence of a replicable psychic effect, unexplainable from a materialistic perspective, allows us to again reasonably consider the proposition that there is an existence beyond the physical. No longer can we necessarily rule out the possibility of prophecy, which incidentally is a tactic used by the biblical criticism. One of the reasons why we have these theories about there being more than one Isaiah, there are others, but this is one reason, is because biblical critics who and analysts who base their theories often on this empirical tradition can't possibly imagine somebody having knowledge of something that's going to happen that hasn't happened yet. And so they say it's not possible for Isaiah to have predicted something 200 years from when he actually lived. Therefore, another Isaiah must have written and added that to the book. Now, okay, that is a possible explanation, but frankly, I think that prophecy is possible, as you can tell from my presentation here. And it's too early, I think, to discount the possibility that Isaiah could foretell the future. In fact, I say if a human with the right training can access information from the past and the future, how can one presume a prophet can't? No longer can we reject the outright possibility of inspiration and revelation, nor can we necessarily assume that God is merely a myth created by superstitious ancestors to account for the things we now can successfully explain through science. No longer can we consider it outside the realm of possibility that some higher being can indeed communicate with representatives here on Earth. Of course, remote viewing doesn't prove God's existence, nor the certainty of an afterlife. It only proves that these things are possible, an option that materialist science has been and conjecture based on my own experiences. I don't want to present it in a way to imply that it's official doctrine. This is a standard disclaimer I always throw in on these things. You guys have to make up your own minds about this. You have to form your own opinions and seek your own guidance. One thing I'm worried about is that someone will latch onto this, remote viewing that is, as some sort of end in itself and turn into a quasi-religious kind of experience, which I don't think it ought to be considered that. It's purely a skill that we can develop. You know, if you can fit it into your religious paradigm, that's fine. But really, remote viewing itself is not any kind of twilight, well, it is one of those twilight zone experience, but it's not any kind of a thing that anybody ought to form a cult around. There are those that are trying, but we're fighting them. Anyway, it is still, let's see, I try to discourage anybody from making RV out to be more than what it is, but it is still something. And apart from its uses in intelligence and a few other specialized applications, it presently has not gone much beyond being a parlor game. Yet it is not the practical uses of remote viewing that I think are important so much as its implications. I have addressed a few of these in this hour, and I hope you have found it useful. And that is conclusion. Do you have any questions? Yes.
You raised the issue of historical change, that there are historical issues or contexts for what remote viewers perceive. This creates a question for me. If you're only given a coordinate, and people given that coordinate, nothing else, is that correct?
Just right.
People given that coordinate have sketched and modeled the things you described. On that coordinate, there previously were other structures, or previously was a meadow or a forest. Or back in the Cretaceous era, it was a swamp.
You might get a dinosaur, yes.
If all you're given is a coordinate, what's the controlling mechanism for this historical perspective that you mentioned partly through?
You know, I should have figured you'd come up with a question like that. It's real appropriate. In fact, you know, this might be an interesting tool for your profession. We can figure out how to make it normative. There are a couple of conventions in this. Of course, first thing is task or intent. There is a certain telepathic component to this that's just understood. And that is when the tasker attaches that number to that target, he wants it addressed in a certain fashion. And somehow the viewer subconscious knows what the target is, knows where it is, whatever that means, and goes there. You know, or brings it to. We don't know how that works. There's no cause and effect, just effect in this. So intent is the first thing. But also, viewers are taught to anchor themselves in space-time. At the top of the session, I won't dig it out, but you probably noticed I had my name, I had the date, I had where I was in general terms, it probably said Fort Meade, and then the time that the session was initiated. And the intent is, unless there is other intent within the tasking, to address the target in real time. And somehow the viewer knows that and does that. There are occasional slippages. If there's something much more interesting historically there than is there at the present, we have had viewers that go into the past and describe really kind of interesting things, you know, and we find out after the fact that they'd gone back 100 years because they thought that it was boring at that time, at least their subconscious did. So anyway, yes?
Have you ever used remote viewing in either your personal life or your religious life?
I actually use it to find parking spaces. And it drives my wife nuts. She, by the way, is here attending, making sure I don't say anything evil about her, and I've already blown that. But anyway, I'll say, you know, I have to be concentrating on this. You know, I have to open my mind up to it and get in the right mental frame of mind. If I just arbitrarily pick a place, I'm usually wrong. But if I just kind of set myself in the right frame of mind, I'll say, down this aisle, I'm going down this aisle. She'll say, there's no parking spaces down there. And I'll be tooling down there, and a guy will back out just as I get there, and I'll pull in, and she'll look at me and not say anything, you know. But just a second. I have actually been asked about the religious thing, too. Part of the problem is you can't task yourself because that automatically engenders AOL. If you say, oh, I want to go back and remote view what really happened in the Mountain Meadows Massacre, you already know what the target is. And you already have preconceived notions about what it is. And so it doesn't do you any good. You don't know if the stuff's legitimate or not. Somebody else has to task you, and you have to have no idea what the target is in order for it to work properly. Okay, back in the back.
You mentioned that there were three different
Okay, how training worked at Fort Meade, you were recruited in the unit. You had no idea what you were volunteering for, except in one or two cases, and those turned out unfortunately. But anyway, I got recruited. I didn't have a clue what was going on until he sat me down and said, listen, we've been looking at you. We think you might be good for this. Our mission is to collect intelligence using parapsychology. Now, I have to set the stage for this. I had been in a parapsychology experiment in seventh grade that had been a total abysmal failure. At that point, I concluded that there was nothing to this, but I'd always wished there was, because I'd always been a science fiction fan. I thought the stuff was fascinating, and I was real disappointed that it just didn't work, you know. So I sit down there, and they tell me this, and I say, collect intelligence using parapsychology. Is there something I have to sign? I want to do this, you know. Because obviously at that point, they were doing it. They're getting paid to do it. It must work, you know. They showed me some stuff afterwards. It was pretty dang convincing. So anyway, I'll talk to you for training afterwards. That's a long question, yeah.
Just skeptic and he's boiling up. The tasker in this case is when you do this. The tasker knows the target, right?
Right.
So how do you do a... A scientist would want to do a blind study when the tasker did. How do you know the tasker isn't influencing the...
This is how... Well, the tasker is, but not in a conventional way. Let me explain here. You've got the viewer. I guess the microphone can't hear me. Oh, well. You've got the viewer at one end of this table, and either he can either be working solo or he can be working with a monitor. The monitor doesn't know what it is. The viewer doesn't know what it is. The tasker was over in another building altogether, and he just wrote down a number and gave it to the tasker or to the monitor. Mm-hmm. It's basically double blind. Now, during training, it's not that way, but training is a special case. You want the people to learn how to do it. You don't want to test their abilities. But, you know, I'm going to that later, too. At any rate, it's at least double blind. Oftentimes, it was triple blind in the operational stuff. We would CIA or DIA or Secret Service, we got tasked by them, JCS tasked us. Those guys would just, the people who we interacted with knew what our methodology was. So they would just give us a number. And so this guy didn't even know what it was, you know. So, and stuff was done that way. You didn't have leakage coming in, you know, any kind of analytic. In fact, we started off with geographic coordinates. This should be fine, interesting. We started with geographic coordinates. The skeptics griped about that because they said, well, somebody could memorize what was the end of all the coordinates and then it wouldn't, you know, they'd just cheat. Now, how many zillion coordinates is that? But there was another reason, you know, another problem, and that was after you've done enough of them, you get a general idea of where that coordinate was. So, you know, we did enough Soviet Union. You get a Soviet Union coordinate. You knew it's going to be snowy, it's going to be cold, it was the wintertime or whatever, you know. And so you start getting a because of your preconceptions about where the coordinate was. So we came up with a thing we called encrypted coordinates, which was really mind-boggling for some people because all it was a random number that was chosen to stand for that target. Now, people who had no problem with a geographic coordinate and a remote viewer getting a geographic coordinate and describing this site, all of a sudden are saying, how do you do that? This number doesn't mean anything. How do they do that? They said, well, you don't have a problem with remote viewing. Why do you have a problem with a random number like that? And they just scratch their heads, you know. So basically, it's that intent thing again, you know, on the telepathic kind of somehow, some kind of telepathic content or whatever. The number is assigned to the target. It might be, when I train people today, I use the date and the number of the target folder. So it's 970, what's today, the 10th? 970510, 279 might be the target folder number, whatever. And that's the number I give them. That has no relation to any spot on the ground or any spot in the universe as it stands. But when I write that down on the target folder and I know in my mind this number stands for this target, I don't know, it works. They go and they describe the pulp mill plant that I've got as a target, or they go and describe the, I just got a new target that I'm just dying to use on some poor student, Cadillac Ranch. And you know those 12 Cadillacs that are stuck nose first in the ground out in Texas? That's going to be a fun one. But at any rate, like I said, I don't know how it works, but it does. Go ahead. I guess somebody else should have had a turn.
I know you're teaching this now. Public level. So I'm just curious, the people that take a class, are they just curious, or do people see commercial practical applications?
You get all kinds. And in fact, the ones that are most reliable are the ones that want to make money with it. They have a motivation, and they're honest about their motivations. But you get a lot of people who just want to develop some side of themselves that they know exists, but their culture has told them it doesn't. A lot of these people are, you know, they're somewhat new agey, but it's interesting. The ones I've got are pretty solid citizens. I have a fairly high up guy in the National Bureau of Standards, or whatever it's called these days, an electrical engineer from Mitsubishi. I've got an executive from Albertsons coming in next month. Who else have I got? I usually can throw. Oh, there was a biochemical. Something, biochemical professor, professor of biochemistry from the University of Vienna that was interested in doing it. He started something else, so he wasn't able to come this year. But, you know, I'm getting fairly reputable, responsible people into these. They aren't the kind of new age, flaky kind of people. Psychologist. I have a psychologist coming week after next, week after that, something like that. He's actually a prison psychologist of some kind. He's going to tell me more about what he does when he gets here.
One more question.
Okay. Whose turn? Oh, you deserve it. Yes, you deserve it. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, this analytic overlay, you on the paper wrote down that was Lumos, but it was Lumos. How was it analytic overlay?
Well, the problem, what I showed you was an early training session. This is, and coordinate remote viewing, or controlled remote viewing, as we now call it, because we don't use a real coordinate. In that, you actually have six stages that you go through, and you only learn them one stage at a time, and I'd only got up through stage three at that point. So that was kind of halfway through the actual process, and that was as far as I knew how to do. And I hadn't learned to deal with other kinds of information that I might be getting later on. This piece of information, Blue Mosque, I would have declared what's known as an AOL signal, which means it's analytic overlay. It has all the markings of analytic overlay, but there's something substantial to it that very closely mimics the site. And so, in a sense, you can kind of look through an AOL signal and see, I'm speaking metaphorically, and see that it very closely conforms to what the real target is. And so, that's why. It was down as an AOL because that's the only thing I could do with it that I knew to do with it up to that point. So, it was handled properly. It just, there was more to it. Okay. Was that it? Oh, wait, she can let her ask a question.
I have two quick questions. Somewhere I heard that the X-Files is based on Stargate. The idea for the X-Files is based on Stargate. That's just, I'm tossing that out.
But actually not, because it came out, when did it start? 92, 93? And Stargate wasn't declassified until 95. So, but I think some of the ideas that have come out of Stargate may have been incorporated into X-Files.
The other thing, I just have a quick question. We came in a little late, and my question is, what started this? What was the purpose? I mean, they gave you a coordinate. What was the purpose for the government to spend that?
Originally?
Yes, originally.
Well, I could give you a real quick history. Nothing starts until another 10 minutes, right? It started actually in the early 70s. The Soviets were rumored to be doing this kind of stuff, and it scared the daylights out of everybody, because if they really could, then nothing was safe. And so the U.S. government decided to reverse engineer, you know, kind of see if we could do it too, and if so, how much damage the Soviets would do if they were doing it. And so they did some experiments in early 70s. CIA ran those and then bailed out when they got stung with this LSD controversy that they were involved in. And it worked so well that they said, heck with counterintelligence, let's start doing our own spying with it, you know. So they, that's kind of a very quick nutshell answer to that. Okay.